We added prison guards, prison lawyers, and others knowledgeable about the American prison system. That experience and intense mentoring by Carlo helped to infuse our little experiment with a kind of situational savvy never before seen in any comparable social science research. It is about 7 p.m. when Carlo and I watch one of the counts on the TV monitor that is recording the day's special events. Then we retreat to my superintendent's office to discuss how things are going and how I should handle tomorrow's visiting night. Suddenly, Warden Jaffe bursts in to report that 8612 is really distraught, once out, and insists on seeing me. Jaffe can't tell whether 8612 is just faking it to get released and then to make some trouble for us, or if he is genuinely feeling ill. He insists that it is my call and not his to make. "Sure, bring him in so I can assess the problem," I say. A sullen, defiant, angry, and confused young man enters the office. "What seems to be the trouble, young man?"
"I can't take it anymore. The guards are hassling me. They're picking on me, putting me in the hole all the time, and..."
"Well, from what I have seen, and I've seen it all, you've brought this all on yourself. You are the most rebellious, insubordinate prisoner in the whole prison."
"I don't care. You've all violated the contract. I didn't expect to get treated like this, you..."
"Stop right there, punk."
Carlo lashes out against 8612 with a vengeance.
"You can't take what? Push-ups? Jumping jacks? Guards calling you names and yelling at you? Is that what you mean by hassling? Don't interrupt me. And you're crying about being put in that closet for a few hours? Let me straighten you out, white boy. You would not last a day at San Quentin. We would all smell your fear and weakness. The guards would be banging you upside your head, and before they put you in their real solitary concrete barren pit that I endured for weeks at a time, they'd throw you to us. Snuffy or some other bad gang boss would have bought you for 2, maybe 3 packs of cigarettes, and your ass would be bleeding bright red, white, and blue. And that'd be just the beginning of turning you into a sissy."
8612 is frozen by the fury of Carlo's harangue. I need to rescue him, because I can sense that Carlo is about to explode. Seeing our prison-like setting has brought to his mind years of torment from which Carlo is but a few months away. "Carlo, thanks for providing this reality check. But I need to know some things from this prisoner before we can proceed properly. 8612, you realize that I have the power to get the guards not to hassle you, if you choose to stay and cooperate. Do you need the money, the rest of which you will forfeit by quitting early?"
"Yeah, sure, but..."
"Okay, then here's the deal. No more guards hassling you. You stay and earn your money, and in return, all you have to do is cooperate from time to time, sharing a little information with me from time to time that might be helpful to me in running this prison."
"Well, I don't know about that."
"Look, think over my offer, and if later on, after a good dinner, you still want to leave, then that will be fine, and you will be paid for time you have served. However, if you choose to continue, make all the money, not be hassled, and cooperate with me, then we can put the first day's problems behind us and start over. Agreed?"
"Maybe, but..."
"No need to decide either way right now. Reflect on my offer and decide later tonight, okay?" As 8612 quietly utters, "Well, all right," I escort him out to the warden's next-door office to be returned to the yard. I tell Jaffe that he is still deciding about staying and will make his decision later on. I had thought up the Faustian bargain on the spot. I had acted like an evil prison administrator, not the good-hearted professor I like to think I am. As a superintendent, I do not want 8612 to leave, because it might have a negative impact on the other inmates, and because I think we might be able to get him to be more cooperative if we have guards back off their abusive behaviors toward him. But I have invited 8612, the rebel leader, to be a snitch, an informer, sharing information with me in return for special privileges. In the prisoner code, a snitch is the lowest form of animal life, and is often kept in solitary by the authorities because if his informer role became known, he would be murdered. Later, Carlo and I retreat to Ricky's restaurant, where I try to put this ugly image behind me for a short time while enjoying Carlo's new stories over a plate of lasagna. The prisoner tells everyone that no one can quit. Back in the yard, guards Arnett and Jay Landry have the prisoners lined up against the wall doing yet another count before the end of their extended day shift. Once more, Stu, 819, is being ridiculed by the guards for being so listless in joining his peers, who are calling out in unison, "Thank you, Mr. Correctional Officer, for a fine day!" The prison entrance door squeaks as it opens. The line of prisoners all look down the hall to see 8612 returning from his meeting with the prison authorities. He announced to them before seeing me that it was his bon voyage meeting. He was quitting, and there was nothing they could do to make him stay any longer. Doug 8612 now pushes his way through the line of his friends into cell 2, throwing himself on his cot. 8612, out here against the wall, Arnett orders. Fuck you, he replies defiantly. Against the wall, 8612. Fuck you, replies 8612. Arnett, somebody help him. Jay Landry asks Arnett, do you have the key to the handcuffs, sir? Still in his cell, 8612 yells out, if I gotta be in here, I'm not gonna put up with any of your shit. As he saunters out into the yard, with half the prisoners lined up on either side of cell 2, Doug, 8612, offers them a new terrible reality. I mean, you know, really. I mean, I couldn't get out. I spent all this time talking to doctors and lawyers and... His voice trails off, and it is not clear what this means. The other prisoners are giggling at him. Standing in front of the other prisoners, defying orders to stand against the wall, 8612 delivers an uppercut to his buddies. He continues to rant in his high-pitched, whiny voice, I couldn't get out. They wouldn't let me out. You can't get out of here. The inmates' initial giggles are replaced by nervous laughter. The guards ignore 8612 as they continue trying to discover where the keys to the handcuffs are, assuming they will handcuff 8612 and stuff him back in the hole if he keeps this up. One prisoner asks 8612, you mean you couldn't break the contract? Another prisoner inquires desperately, but not of anyone in particular. Can I cancel my contract? Arnett toughens up. No talking on the line. 8612 will be around later for you all to talk with. This revelation from one of their respected leaders is a powerful blow to the prisoners' resolve and defiance. Glenn, 3401, reported on the impact of 8612's assertion. He said you can't get out. You felt like you were really a prisoner. Maybe you were a prisoner in Zimbardo's experiment, and maybe you were getting paid for it, but damn it, you were a prisoner. You were really a prisoner. He begins to fantasize some worst-case scenarios. The thought that we had signed our lives away for 2 weeks, body and soul, was exceptionally frightening. The actual belief that we are really prisoners was real. One couldn't escape without truly drastic action, followed by a series of unknown consequences. Would the Palo Alto police try to pick us up again? Would we get paid? How do I get my wallet back? Rich, 1037, who had been a problem for the guards all day long, was also stunned by this new realization. He later reported, I was told that I couldn't quit. At that point, I felt it was really a prison. There's no way I can describe how I felt at that moment. I felt totally helpless, more helpless than I have ever felt before. It was evident to me that 8612 had trapped himself in multiple dilemmas. He was caught between wanting to be the tough guy rebel leader, but not wanting to deal with the guards hassling, wanting to stay and earn the money he needed, but not wanting to be my informer. He was probably planning to become a double agent, lying to me or misleading me about prisoner activities, but not sure of his ability to carry off that deception. He should have immediately refused my offer to trade up for some comfort by becoming the official snitch, but he did not. At that moment, if he had insisted on being released, I would have had to allow him that option. Again, maybe he was too shamed by Carlo's taunting him to yield readily in front of him. All of these were possible mind games that he resolved by insisting to the others that it was our official decision not to release him, putting the blame on the system. Nothing could have had a more transformative impact on the prisoners than the sudden news that, in this experiment, they had lost their liberty to quit on demand, lost their power to walk out at will. At that moment, the Stanford Prison experiment was changed into the Stanford Prison, not by any top-down formal declarations by the staff, but by this bottom-up declaration from one of the prisoners themselves. Just as the prisoner rebellion changed the way the guards began to think about the prisoners as dangerous, this prisoner's assertion about no one being allowed to quit changed the way all the mock prisoners felt about their new status as helpless prisoners. We're back. It's night shift time. As if things were not bad enough for the prisoners, it is now night shift time once again. Hellman and Burdan have been pacing the yard, waiting for the day shift to move out. They are wielding their billy clubs, yelling something into cell 2, threatening 8612, insisting that a prisoner get back from the door, and pointing the fire extinguisher at the cell, shouting to ask whether they want more of this cool carbon dioxide spray in their faces. A prisoner asks guard Jeff Landry, "Mr. Correctional Officer, I have a request. It's somebody's birthday tonight. Can we sing Happy Birthday?" Before Landry can answer, Hellman replies from the background, "We'll sing Happy Birthday at lineup. Now it's dinner time. Three at a time." The prisoners now sit around a table laid out in the middle of the yard to eat their skimpy dinner. No talking allowed. Reviewing the tapes of this shift, I see a prisoner being brought in through the main doors by Burdan. The prisoner, who had just attempted to escape, stands at attention in the center of the hallway just beyond the dinner table. He is blindfolded. Landry asks the prisoner how he removed the lock on the door. He refuses to spill the beans. When the blindfold is taken off the escapee, Jeff warns menacingly, "If we see your hands near that lock, 8612, we'll have something really good for you." It was Doug, 8612, who tried the escape plan. Landry pushes him back into his cell, where 8612 begins to scream obscenities again, louder than before, and a stream of "fuck yous" floods the yard. Hellman says wearily into cell 2, "8612, your game is getting very old. Very old. It's not even amusing anymore." The guards rush to the dinner table to stop 5486 from conferring with his cellmates, who have been forbidden to communicate. Jeff Landry shouts at 5486, "Hey, hey! We can't deprive you of a meal, but we can take the rest of it away. You've had something. The warden says we can't deprive you of meals, but you've already had a meal, at least part of it, so we can take the rest away." He then makes a general pronouncement to everyone. "You guys seem to have forgotten about all of the privileges we can give you." He reminds them of the visiting hours tomorrow, which, of course, could be canceled if there is a lockdown. Some prisoners who are still eating say that they have not forgotten about Tuesday's 7 o'clock visiting hours and are looking forward to them. Jeff Landry insists that 8612 put back on his stocking cap, which he had taken off during dinner. "We wouldn't want you dropping anything out of your hair into your meal and getting sick on it." 8612 responds strangely, as though he is losing contact with reality. "I can't put it on my head. It's too tight. I'll get a headache." "What? I know that's really weird. That's why I'm trying to get out of here. They keep saying, 'No, you won't get a headache,' but I know I will get a headache." Now it becomes Rich 1037's turn to be despondent and detached. He is looking glassy-eyed, speaking only in a slow monotone. Lying on the floor of his cell, he keeps coughing, insists on seeing the superintendent. I see him when I return from my dinner, give him some cough drops, and tell him that he can leave if he feels he can't take it anymore, but that things will go better if he does not spend so much time and energy rebelling. He reports feeling better and promises to try his best. The guards next turn their attention on Paul, 5704, who is now being more assertive, as if to stand in for former rebel leader Doug, 8612.
"You don't look too happy, 5704, Landry says, as Hellman starts running his club against the bars of the cell door, making a loud clanging sound.
Burdan adds, "You think they'd like that?" The loud bar clanging. "After lights out, maybe tonight?" 5704 attempts a joke, but the guards are not laughing, although some of the prisoners are. Landry says,
"Oh, that's good. That's real good. Keep it up, really. We're really getting entertained now. I haven't heard this type of kid stuff in about 10 years.
The guards, standing tall, all in a row, stare at 8612, who is eating slowly and by himself. With one hand on their hips and the other swinging their billy clubs menacingly, the guards display a united front.
"We have a bunch of resistors, revolutionaries here," exclaims Jeff Landry.
8612 then bolts up from the dinner table and races across to the rear wall, where he rips down the black scrim covering the video camera. The guards grab him and drag him back into the hole yet again. He says sarcastically,
"Sorry, guys."
One of them responds,
"You're sorry, huh? We'll have something for you later that you will be sorry for."
When Hellman and Burdan both start banging on the door of the hole with their billy clubs, 8612 starts screaming that it is deafening and is making his headache worse. Doug, 8612, yells out,
"Fucking don't do that, man. It hurts my ears."
Burdan,
"Maybe you'll think about that before you want to do something that gets you into the hole next time, 8612.
8612 answers,
"Nah, you can just fuck off, buddy. Next time the doors go down, I mean it."
He is threatening to tear down the door to his cell, the entrance door, and perhaps he means the wall where the observation camera is located. A prisoner asks if they'll be having a movie tonight, as they had expected to get when the original details of the prison were described to them. A guard replies,
"I don't know if we'll ever have a movie."
The guards openly discuss the consequences of damaging prison property, and Hellman grabs a copy of the prison rules, reading off the rule about damaging prison property. As he leans against cell one's doorframe and twirls his billy club, he seems to be inhaling confidence and dominance moment by moment. Instead of movie time, he will give them either work or R&R time, Hellman tells his buddies. Hellman,
"Okay, let's have your attention, please. We have some fun lined up for everyone tonight. Cell 3, you're on rest and recreation. You can do what you please because you washed your dishes and did your chores well. Cell 2, you still got a little bit of work to do. And cell 1, we've got a great blanket for you to pick all the stickers out of."
"Okay, bring them on in here, officer. Let's let them see.
They're gonna do just fine for cell 1 to work on tonight if they want to sleep on a blanket without stickers."
Landry hands Hellman some blankets coated with a new collection of stickers.
"Oh, isn't that a beauty?" He continues his monologue. "Just look at that blanket, ladies and gentlemen. Look at that blanket. Isn't that a masterpiece? I want you to take each and every one of those stickers out of that blanket, because that's what you're going to have to sleep on."
A prisoner tells him,
"We'll just sleep on the floor."
To which Landry replies simply,
"Suit yourself. Suit yourself."
It is interesting to see how Jeff Landry vacillates between the tough guard and good guard roles. He still has not relinquished control to Hellman, to whose dominance he may aspire at some level, while feeling greater sympathy for the prisoners than Hellman seems capable of. In a later interview, the thoughtful prisoner, Jim, 4325, describes Hellman as one of the bad guards, nicknaming him John Wayne. He describes the Landry brothers as two of the good guards, while most other prisoners agree that Jeff Landry was more often good than bad as a guard. A prisoner in Cell 3 asks whether it would be possible for them to get some books to read. Hellman suggests giving them all a couple of copies of the rules as their bedtime reading material. Now it is time for another count.
Okay, there'll be no goofing off tonight, remember? Let's start at 2093, and let's count off just so we can keep in practice, he says.
Verdan jumps on the bandwagon, walks right up in the prisoners' faces, and says,
We didn't teach you to count that way. Loud, clear, and fast, 5704. You're sure slow enough. You can start off with the jumping jacks.
The guards' punishment is becoming indiscriminate. They're no longer punishing prisoners for any specific reason. 5704 is having none of that.
I'm not going to do it.
Verdan forces him into it, so he goes down, but not far enough, apparently.
Down, man, down!
Pushing him down by pressing on his back with his billy club.
Don't push, man!
What do you mean, don't push?
In a ridiculing tone.
Well, that's what I said, don't push.
Just go on now and do your push-ups, Verdan orders.
Now, get back in line.
Verdan is decidedly much more vocal and involved than he was before, but Hellman is still clearly the alpha male. However, when Verdan and Hellman become the dynamic duo, suddenly Jeff Landry recedes into the background or is not on the yard scene at all. Even 2093, the best prisoner, Sarge, is forced to do push-ups and jumping jacks for no apparent reason.
Ah, that's nice. See how he does those? He's got a lot of energy tonight, says Hellman.
Then he turns on 3401.
Are you smiling? What are you smiling about?
His sidekick, Verdan, chimes in.
Are you smiling, 3401? You think this is funny? You want to sleep tonight? I don't want to see anyone smiling. This is no locker room here. If I see one person smile, it's going to be jumping jacks for everyone for a long time.
Hellman assures them. Picking up on the prisoners' need to lighten their grim surroundings, Hellman tells Verdan a joke for the benefit of the grim prisoners.
Officer, did you hear the one about the dog with no legs? Every night his owner would take him out for a drag.
He and Verdan laugh, but note that the prisoners do not laugh. Verdan chides him.
They don't like your joke, officer.
Did you like my joke, 5486?
Jerry, 5486 prisoner, answers truthfully,
No.
Come out here and do 10 push-ups for not liking my joke, and do 5 more for smiling, 15 in all.
Hellman is on a roll. He makes all the prisoners face the wall. Then, when they turn around, he shows them the one-armed pencil salesman. He puts one hand down his pants and puts his finger at his crotch, pushing out his pants as if he had an erection. The prisoners are told not to laugh. Some do laugh and are then forced to do push-ups or sit-ups. 3401 says he didn't think it was funny, but he has to do push-ups for being honest. Next comes singing their numbers. Hellman asks Sarge, 2093, if that sounded like singing.
It sounded like singing to me, Mr. Correctional Officer.
Hellman makes him do push-ups for disagreeing with his judgment. Unexpectedly, Sarge asks,
May I do more, sir?
You can do 10 if you like.
Then Sarge challenges him in an even more dramatic way.
Shall I do them until I drop?
Sure, whatever.
Hellman and Verdan are unsure how to react to this taunt, but the prisoners look at one another in dismay, knowing that Sarge may set new criteria for self-inflicted punishment that will then be imposed on them. He is becoming a sick joke to them all. When next the prisoners are asked to count off in a complicated order, Verdan adds mockingly,
That shouldn't be so hard for boys with so much education.
In a sense, he is picking up on the current conservative ridicule of educated college people as effete intellectual snobs, even though, of course, he is a college student himself. The prisoners are asked if they need their blankets and beds. All say they do.
And what? Hellman asks. Did you boys do to deserve beds and blankets?
We took the foxtails out of our blankets, says one of them.
He tells them to never say foxtails. They should call them stickers. Here is a simple instance of power determining language use, which in turn creates reality. Once the prisoners call them stickers, Burdan says that they should get their pillows and blankets. Hellman comes back with blankets and pillows under his arms. He then hands them out to everyone except prisoner 5704. He asks him why it took him so long to get to work.
You feel like having a pillow?
Why should I give you a pillow if you didn't feel like working?
Good karma?
Answers 5704, feeling a bit playful.
I'll ask you again. Why should I give you a pillow?
Because I'm asking you to, Mr. Correctional Officer.
But you didn't get to work until 10 minutes after everyone else did, says Hellman. He adds, see to it that in the future you do work when you are told.
Despite this misbehavior, Hellman finally relents and gives him the pillow. Not to be totally upstaged by Hellman, Burdan tells 5704,
thank him real sweet.
Thank you.
Say it again. Say, bless you, Mr. Correctional Officer.
The sarcasm seeps through heavily. Hellman successfully isolates 5704 from his revolutionary comrades by making him beg for a pillow. Simple self-interest is starting to win out over prisoner solidarity. Happy birthday, prisoner 5704. Prisoner Jerry, 5486, reminds the guard of his request to sing Happy Birthday to 5704, which is a curious request at this point, given that the prisoners are so tired and the guards are about to let them return to their cells and to sleep. Perhaps it is a measure of their connection with normal rituals in the outside world, or a small way to normalize what is rapidly approaching abnormal. Burdan tells Hellman,
we have a point of discussion from prisoner 5486, officer. He wants to do the happy birthday song.
Hellman is upset when the birthday song is intended for 5704.
It's your birthday, and you didn't work.
The prisoner replies that he shouldn't have to work on his birthday. The guards go down the line and ask each one to say aloud whether he does or does not want to sing the birthday song. Each agrees that it is right to sing the birthday song to 5704 tonight. Prisoner Hubby, 7258, is then ordered to lead the others in singing Happy Birthday, the only pleasant sound in this place all day and night. The first time through, there is a mixture of ways in which the recipient is addressed. Some sing Happy Birthday to Comrade, others to 5704. As soon as this happens, Hellman and Burdan both scream at them. Burdan reminds them,
this gentleman's name is 5704. Now take it from the top.
Hellman compliments 7258 for his singing.
You give them a swing tempo and then you sing it straight.
He says that about cut-time music, showing off a bit of his musical knowledge. But he then requests they sing the song again in a more familiar style, and they do. But their performance is not good enough, so again they are told,
let's have a little enthusiasm. A boy's birthday only happens once a year.
This prisoner-initiated break in routine to share some positive feeling among themselves is turned into another occasion of learning routinized dominance and submission. The final breakdown and release of 8612. After lights out, and after Doug, 8612, is finally turned out of solitary for the nth time, he goes ballistic.
I mean, Jesus Christ, I'm burning up inside. Don't you know?
The prisoner is screaming his angry confusion and torment to the warden during his second visit with Jaffe.
I want to get out. This is all fucked up inside. I can't stand another night. I just can't take it anymore. I gotta have a lawyer. Do I have a right to ask for a lawyer? Contact my mother.
Trying to remind himself that this is just an experiment, he continues raving.
You're messing up my head, man, my head. This is an experiment.
That contract is not serfdom. You have no right to fuck with my head.
He threatens to do anything necessary to get out, even to slit his wrists.
I'll do anything to get out. I'll wreck your cameras, and I'll hurt the guards.
The warden tries his best to comfort him, but 8612 is having none of it. He cries and screams louder and louder. Jaffe assures 8612 that as soon as he can contact one of the psychological counselors, his request will be seriously considered. A short while later, Craig Haney returns from his late dinner and, after listening to Jaffe's tape recording of this dramatic scene, he interviews 8612 to determine whether he should be released immediately based on such severe emotional distress. At the time, we were all uncertain about the legitimacy of 8612's reactions. He might be just play-acting. A check of his background information revealed that he was also a leading anti-war activist at his university, just last year. How could he really be breaking down in only 36 hours? 8612 was indeed confused, as he revealed to us later.
I couldn't decide whether the prison experience had really freaked me out or whether I had induced those reactions purposefully.
The conflict that Craig Haney was experiencing over being forced to make this decision on his own while I was out having dinner is vividly expressed in his later analysis. Although in retrospect it seems like an easy call, at the time it was a daunting one. I was a second-year graduate student. We had invested a great deal of time, effort, and money into this project, and I knew that the early release of a participant would compromise the experimental design we had carefully drawn up and implemented. As experimenters, none of us had predicted an event like this, and of course we had devised no contingency plan to cover it. On the other hand, it was obvious that this young man was more disturbed by his brief experience in the Stanford prison than any of us had expected any of the participants to be, even by the end of 2 weeks. So I decided to release prisoner 8612, going with the ethical humanitarian decision over the experimental one. Craig contacted 8612's girlfriend, who quickly came by and collected him and his belongings. Craig reminded the two of them that if this distress continued, he could visit student health in the morning, because we had arranged for some of its staff to help deal with any such reactions. Fortunately, Craig made the right decision based on both humane considerations and legal ones. It was also the right decision considering the probable negative effect on the staff and inmates of keeping 8612 imprisoned in his state of emotional disarray. However, when Craig later informed Kurt and me about his decision to release 8612, we were skeptical and thought that he had been taken in, conned by a good acting job. However, after a long discussion of all the evidence, we agreed that he had done the right thing. But then we had to explain why this extreme reaction had occurred so suddenly, almost at the very start of our 2-week adventure. Even though personality tests had revealed no hint of mental instability, we persuaded ourselves that the emotional distress 8612 revealed was the product of his overly sensitive personality and his overreaction to our simulated prison conditions. Together, Craig, Kurt, and I engaged in a bit of groupthink, advancing the rationalization that there must have been a flaw in our selection process that had allowed such a damaged person to slip by our screening, while ignoring the other possibility that the situational forces operating in this prison simulation had become overwhelming for him. Consider for a moment the meaning of that judgment. Here we were in the midst of a study designed to demonstrate the power of situational forces over dispositional tendencies, yet we were making a dispositional attribution. In retrospect, Craig expressed the fallacy in our thinking aptly. It was only later that we appreciated this obvious irony, that we had dispositionally explained the first truly unexpected and extraordinary demonstration of situational power in our study by resorting to precisely the kind of thinking we had designed the study to challenge and critique. Confusion remained about 8612's ulterior motives.
On the one hand, we wondered, was he really out of control, suffering from an extreme stress reaction, and so, of course, had to be released? Alternatively, had he started out by pretending to be crazy, knowing that if he did a good job, we would have to release him? It might be that, in spite of himself, he had ended up temporarily crazed by his over-the-top method acting. In a later report, 8612 complicates any simple understanding of his reactions. "I left when I should have stayed. That was very bad. The revolution isn't going to be fun, and I must see that. I should have stayed because it helps the fascists knowing that revolutionary leaders will desert when things get rough, that they are just manipulators. And I should have fought for what was right and not thought of my interests." Shortly after 8612 was terminated, one of the guards overheard the prisoners in cell 2 discussing a plot in which Doug would return the next day with a band of his buddies to trash our prison and liberate the prisoners. It sounded to me like a far-fetched rumor until a guard reported seeing 8612 sneaking around the hallways of the psychology department the next morning. I ordered the guards to capture him and return him to the prison, since he had probably been released under false pretenses. Not sick, just tricking us. Now I knew that I had to prepare for an all-out assault on my prison. How could we avert a major violent confrontation? What could we do to keep our prison functioning? And, oh yes, our experiment also continuing.